is gonna have the news. It's Monday, March 2nd, 2020. It's LA Podcast. I'm Hayes Davenport here with Alyssa Walker, Scott Frazier. Exhausting. I was deathly ill basically the entire week.
Yeah.
But even with that, I could feel
an additional weight on bearing down on you.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're feeling better, by the way.
I am. I feel great. Yeah. I feel great.
Don't oversell it.
Let's talk about some of the different things that happened this week. Does anyone have a story?
I'll start. I was a guest host on a podcast this week with my friend Jessica Helfand. It was the Observatory, a podcast put out by Design Observer, longtime observers of design and culture. Jessica is an old friend of mine, and she's here teaching a class at Caltech. So she's been a New Englander dropped into, you know, LA, kind of like Woody Allen style or whatever. I don't know, like Annie Hall type thing.
Yeah. Right.
And I just thought it was so fun. We talked about homelessness and we talked about different things that were happening with like LACMA, a lot of stuff we talk about on the show. So I encourage you to go listen to it. But I thought it was so funny that all she wanted to talk about was Nithya, the candidate that we talk about often on the show. Because even for somebody who has just come here, you know, temporarily, she was so overwhelmed by her platform and her thinking and her messaging and the design of her posters, perhaps. Wow. So yeah. I just thought that was pretty striking. And I think it's cool that some of these candidates are getting national attention, which is really exciting.
There are certain pockets of social media where I've seen, like, you know, the LA comedy scene especially has been so, like, over the top and boosting Nithya over the past. Sarah Silverman posted about her the other day, and like
the Americana at brand meme account endorsed Nithya.
That was very exciting. But I have started to see some people that don't live in LA but just follow comedians and like start to be like, what is happening? Like, what is going on? Who is this person?
That LA comedy scene has become a fount of leftist political activity. I mean, I guess it has been.
There's a thing that happened where after Trump got elected, a lot of comedy people, you could see it happen on Twitter, stopped doing jokes for the most part and started really engaging politically. They just basically felt bad about how they lived their lives up to that point. And I think what you're seeing is people just finding a place to plug in locally and really seizing on it. Is my theory. I don't even really know exactly.
Yeah, you don't have any experience with this personally.
No.
I don't have much of an LA story this week. I'll defer to you, Hayes, if you have anything.
I have a story actually from the Nithya campaign that this is more of like a policy realization, that like a policy thing I didn't know about that is so nuts, has been driving me up the wall all week. Okay, so Nithya's running against the incumbent, David Rue, who has raised a record-setting amount of money in this campaign, over $1 million. Far and away the most of anyone in the city, probably ever. So Nithya and the other person running in the race, Sarah Kate Levy, have both raised about $300,000, a little less than $300,000, which, by the way, in any normal race would be a huge amount of money for a city council race, because the maximum donation is $800. It's hard to like stack up big numbers with like pretty small donations. But a way to level the playing field are these matching funds.
Mm-hmm.
Nice program that the city has that says, hey, if you can accumulate enough small dollar donations from within the city, we will match that 6-1 up to $151,000. So it takes these like grassroots candidates that are still getting a lot of support locally, and the city says, okay, here's $151,000 for you to be able to catch up with these higher raising candidates. And the rule, if you take matching funds, is you can't self-fund beyond like a certain amount, like $30,000 is the most you can put into your campaign. And you also can't spend more than $500,000. And so the idea is that like really rich campaigns should be able to just take taxpayer money and spend it, even though they've already raised a huge amount.
Yeah.
Except if independent expenditure committees, this outside money, like PACs, basically.
Similar to PACs, yeah.
Yes. If they spend more than, I think, $80,000 in the race, then the spending caps go away.
What?
Cumulative.
And it doesn't matter who they are spending money on. So take an example. This is just an example where an incumbent has raised $1 million
yeah,
and probably 150,000 of independent expenditure money comes in supporting the incumbent.
That same candidate.
As well. So it's also going to him. That then allows the incumbent to take the $151,000 in public taxpayer money, matching funds, and spend that as
however
well.
However they want. That's crazy.
It is so stupid.
How does that...
you ever thought that the city council could come up with a policy that would actually level the playing field for grassroots candidates and actually work the way it is intended. Instead, it just is a gift to the richest candidates out there who are the ones who are going to be getting all the IE support.
You could steer a fucking cruise ship. That's not even like a loophole. That is absurd.
It is so stupid.
You cannot use this money unless you are rich enough to use it with just like total impunity. That is mind blowing.
Yeah. And luckily you could paper over the loophole with the number of David Rube mailers that I've got the past. Sometimes three a day is the max that I've received, including these Slate mailers that candidates can buy their way onto. But that is how he has, not only has he raised over $1 million, he has spent over $1 million as well. And it's mostly manifest in these mailers.
I want to say just like for a sense of scope, the congressional races, which are typically a lot more expensive to run. You got like TV ads and things like that, especially here in California. The richest campaign in the country, the richest campaign is Adam Schiff in California, 28. Wow. He has come into national prominence, his household name, and he has something like $7 million cash on hand. It's a ton of money. Democrats from all over the country are donating to this guy, especially after the impeachment trial. He became this hero among a certain class of American liberal. And then, like, you have David Rue, who is breaking records, well over $1 million for this local race. Nobody's heard of him. Like, you couldn't find people who know who he is in his district.
And I want to point out, in terms of small dollar donations, he has raised, in terms of donations of less than $100, he's raised about $5,000 out of that million. So it is it is not coming from uninterested parties who are just like Adam Schiff. Just like, please, sir, please take my last $3, just like whatever you need, which I'm sure is actually happening to Adam Schiff. He's not going around asking for this. He's not running a super competitive, you know, there has a lot of people running against him, but he's likely to win by a lot.
Yes.
$7 million. I'm amazed that
the most of any and most congressional candidates, I feel like, would kill to even be in David Rue's position because
to have $1 million. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Right.
Of course. Let's talk about coronavirus. You've heard of this thing?
No, I haven't heard of it.
So you might have it.
Never heard of it.
Alyssa sits down today and starts sneezing and Hayes just goes, that's interesting.
Yeah, are these mics disinfected after every use when we sit down?
I worry about the podcasting industry in general. It's a lot of...
Rip through this industry. Yeah.
So for weeks ago, I remember some of the first cases that were documented in the United States were found in there. I think there was one in LA County and there was one in Orange County. Mm-hmm. But now as more are being discovered that were community spread, I think they call it, which is like people didn't get it from international travel. They got it from some unknown way within the U.S. I think there are two cases up at like UC Davis and in that area in Northern California and couple like along the West Coast, like I think the first death was in Washington State.
Right.
It does seem to be approaching LA more and more. And the biggest frenzy this week was around this flight attendant for Korean Air that had flown into Los Angeles and spent time in LA and then left and
developed symptoms
later. Is that
the LA County case or is there a different person?
That's a different person that I think had an explicable
had been to China or something like that, right?
Something like that. Yeah.
So yeah, we saw an eater, a story that's very helpful this time to try to suppress the panic that starts to come around, especially around certain groups in this country who are connected to China or Korea or, you know, all these people are calling it, you know, the Chinese virus. And it's a very dangerous moment that we have, especially when you have something like wanting to close the southern border of the country to prevent
a zero threat,
actually. Like, we have more cases than Mexico. But I think what Eater did that was so great is just got to the bottom of what was happening at this in this story, which was really just people posting things on a Korean like chat app, Korean language chat app, and just spreading misinformation, which we're going to see happening a lot in these situations. So there were particular restaurants that people were claiming that were unsafe to go to. And it's, I don't know how, I haven't been out and I plan to go to many Korean restaurants this week in my neighborhood and make sure that I am spending money there. But I guess in San Francisco, Chinatown is a ghost town, and people have been saying ridiculous things and, you know, really trying to stop people from going out and, you know, going to these markets and stuff. And here in LA County, also, there's a really troubling video that somebody recorded on a metro train of a guy seeing a woman of Asian descent. She is Thai American, she said later, and he's yelling at her, "You dropped your coronavirus on our own public transit system here."
Yeah, so the dangerous thing here is, well, I mean, there are a couple of dangerous things. One is the racism, which, I mean, we've already seen just be fanned and sort of incited by the government, by the federal government, but also just the panic that people have when they have a sense that there is an uncontrolled virus outbreak, which is sort of what Hayes was talking about at the beginning. What we've started to see in California now, the community, what did you call it?
Community spread.
The community spread incidence of the disease, where I think the original aspiration of the U.S. government, of other national governments internationally, was to make sure that there was a chain where they could actually determine how the virus was getting transmitted, thereby allowing them to quarantine people who were known to have symptoms until such time as they were no longer contagious and prevent the spread of it into communities. We can now say that that has not happened, particularly in America. There was somebody who passed away from the disease in Seattle. I think that was not a community spread incident, but there are going to be more. I mean, just by virtue of the fact that we are having community spread incidences of this, we can say for certain there are other people who have caught it this way, and that number will continue to rise. One of the things, though, that I think encourages people in LA as elsewhere to be sort of like the worst version of themselves is the total lack of information that is available about the disease, the total lack of testing, the knowledge that people are not going to know if they have this disease until it's too late. So we can really say, like, the federal response, this is almost entirely a federal government concern, has not been sufficient to allay the sort of panic that might develop here, which is something that we're going to continue to have to deal with over the coming weeks.
I'm curious what will happen with the racialized response to this as the pandemic grows, if it does, where, you know, eventually enough people are getting this that it becomes less like an Asian virus and something that is just everywhere. What I do worry about is, even more if that's possible, stigmatization of people who are homeless in LA, where when you think about the circumstances that leads to the spread of viruses, people that are not getting regular showers, have nowhere to wash their hands. They're just like, wash your hands, don't touch your face. Like, people don't have access to a sink anywhere, ever. And not just people who live in encampments. I really worry about what this will do to the need to build shelters in these communities.
Like,
you can see, like, that, how it could happen where the way these shelters are constructed, people don't really have private space. They kind of have basically a cot in a cubicle right next to a bunch of other people. Sometimes you share one with another person, and you could just see a virus going through a facility like that in a day, and it becomes like a triage unit.
Absolutely. I mean, especially considering we know that we have people who are chronically homeless, who are senior. We know that we have people who are immunocompromised that are living on our streets. These are people who are very, very at risk right now. And I think that the point too that you made about stigmatization is a real concern that Angelenos should have, because we already have populations here that are being stigmatized by local leaders, particularly the homeless individuals that we have living in our communities. And then we also have the stigmatization that's going on nationally. The response of the Trump administration has been, as Alyssa said, to restrict travel across the southern border in response to a particularly acute outbreak in Iran, which we still don't have a ton of details about. Mm-hmm. The federal government has put a total ban on people returning from Iran for, I believe, 2 weeks. This is kind of a nightmare scenario, I would say, in terms of the potential for this sort of viral outbreak to be used in racially discriminatory ways or policies that are intended to punish specific groups. And I'm worried that we will see that. I'm worried in LA in particular that we'll see people using the notion of public health as a means of what is already in process, sweeping people off of the streets into facilities against their will. That is something that seems like it's in line with what our council members and our mayor have publicly said that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. I think something else to think about, too, is the economic impact of this, whether or not a lot of people get sick or die. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But we're going to see schools being closed, for example, in the Seattle area. I mean, they just went ahead and did it. They didn't maybe really need to do it, but they're, you know, there's all these precautionary actions that people are taking. Events will be canceled, like large scale things that we've spent a lot. The Olympics might be canceled. You know, we have to start thinking, which might be a good thing. We have to start thinking about like how we're going to be impacted. And I think and it's going to impact those same groups, like people who don't have sick leave to be able to stay home, people who are just going to go to their jobs anyway because they have to make money. It's going to, the most marginalized people in this city are going to be impacted the worst. And we have to think about people being people who have means, have money, have sick leave, have the ability to take care of our kids if they stay home from school, how we can help people mm-hmm. without maybe being able to have physical contact with them. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about this. The port, they said this week,
right,
the imports are slowing. Yeah. So how
containers coming
how
in.
Does that start to impact, you know, the whole, you know, localized economy in Long Beach and San Pedro? And how does that ripple out through every single store and shifts getting cut and people? So we have to really start to think about, even if nothing happens on a health perspective, the economic impact is already happening mm-hmm. for the city.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a major impact, and particularly with respect to shipping at the ports. It's going to be an impact that's felt over the course of months. For a certain segment of the population, the economic impacts are kind of locked in. I mean, they could get worse, but it will be felt throughout probably 2020. The combined ports of LA and Long Beach, I think we've mentioned before on this show, handle somewhere in the region of 40% of the imports. A huge number of imports coming from the mainland of China. So there is going to be economic slowdowns that are felt here. As Alyssa said, that also spirals out into manufacturing and the sale of goods and things like that. We also have, of course, there have been stories about a number of international cities where tourists go, LA being one of the most sought after destinations for tourists in the world. It is also an open question whether or not that part of the economy, the service and hospitality industry, will also see a hit there. So
let's talk about another vulnerable population to coronavirus, seniors. LA City, not county, just LA City, has 500,000 residents who are 65 or older. It is our fastest growing demographic right. here and throughout California. I don't think people think of LA as being like a city with such a huge population of seniors, but it really, really is. And how to help like those people, like checking on people in your neighborhood and things like that. Like, I don't know really what the role is for like how people can pitch in on this, but we're just potentially facing these shocking effects. One thing I was reading about that I don't think we really know yet is whether or not this virus is affected by hot or cold weather.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I did see that. So there's been more cases in colder climates, right? Like,
is that true so far?
I mean, I saw somebody say that the infection rate was, it's just it's more pronounced in places that were experiencing colder weather, which I found was interesting.
That would be good for LA. I guess it's closest to SARS and MERS, one of which is more of a cold weather virus and the other of which is not really affected by the weather.
February might be helping us after all.
Yeah.
Good job.
Just very briefly, and it is related to how everyone I know has gotten sick lately. We had the driest February basically ever. I think we had 0.06 inches of rain over the entire month. Supposed to be the rainiest month of the year. This is coming after an incredibly dry January as well. I can feel it. All of my freaking membranes are crackling. It's so, so dry. We had a series of really rainy months. November was super rainy. December, I think we did okay. But we have a little coming up,
it's
right?
It's just supposedly. Always, supposedly we have a little bit overnight, I think was what we were talking about, Alyssa.
Overnight tonight?
Yeah, Sunday night.
Sunday night, okay.
Yeah, it's been bad. I feel like with respect to, and I don't know. I mean, going back to the previous drought, it always feels like even when we have a really good rainy month, like December of last year, we have this like, I don't even know. We just have like a pendulum over our heads or like a blade or something where it's just like the drought is coming back. And now most of California is re-entering drought conditions. And it really didn't take that long. Mm-hmm. Even on the heels of some really good rainy months, you can end up in a position where it all just turns into historically dry weather. There hasn't been a single like drop, I think, in Northern California, whereas they are always reminding us it really counts for the state's snowpack and water levels. So is this the drought that never ends?
There's one possibility for a March miracle I've been seeing. So there is like a 5-week pattern that might sweep us with like a little atmospheric river. Uh-huh. But that would be, a March miracle indeed.
Because it feels like if we had a rainless March, then that would be basically no rain since December.
Yeah.
And then the plants would be dried out to a degree that I assume would make the fire danger just like off the charts.
Yeah.
So we would desperately need for that to happen to live. Let's get back to these elections. There's only, so as you're listening to this, election day, the final election day is tomorrow. You can go vote now at any of the LA's voting centers, and you can look up where the closest one is at lavote.net. None of us have had an experience at a voting center, correct?
No, I went.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You went. Yeah, I went on the first day.
And it was fine.
I have heard from people on Twitter that some of the same issues, particularly as it relates to the ability to turn on the machines, have persisted throughout the voting process.
Just leave them on. Yeah.
So that appears to be a kink that is still being worked out. However, like I said, my experience was relatively seamless once they got the machine turned on. So,
and because the elections are so close at hand, we are seeing a lot of smears. It is smear season. In particular, up in the Council District 12, the Northridge, Porter Ranch area. We've talked about this race a lot over the past year. Lorraine Lundquist, environmental scientist, is running against John Lee for the second time. John Lee won a special election against Dr. Lundquist back in August or something like that. And they are now facing off again. John Lee is a Republican until very recently, apparently changed his designation to no party preference a few weeks ago. But during the last election, John Lee's campaign smeared Dr. Lundquist, basically red baited her and talked about how the Democratic Socialists supported her and how she wants to take away your car and like all this other.
She's an environmental extremist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now they are still doing that, but are simultaneously sending out mailers saying that she's too conservative as well.
She has a hidden right wing agenda or something.
Yes, because she attended and taught at a high school or a college?
A high school, right?
Yes, a high school from the Christian Scientist tradition that had a lot of intolerant policies related to the sexuality of the students going there. And so they accused her of taking money from this dark network of bigots, when all the evidence shows that she was part of a group at that school to change these policies, has always been a progressive ever since she was a teenager.
Right.
And has never, ever, ever subscribed to any like bigotry, any policy like this at all. But to be attacking her from both sides on these issues, being both a liberal extremist and a secret bigot conservative, yeah, is so repugnant. And I also want to call out who is doing this. It's Working Californians PAC or something like that it's called. But it is the Union of the Department of Water and Power, the spokesman for which is a guy named Michael Trujillo, who is like this big strategist in Democratic politics. I've heard people talk about Michael Trujillo for a long time. He's a big Warren supporter on Twitter and things like that. But it's just something that goes to show that in Los Angeles, this like party designation doesn't really mean anything. Like, if you're willing to put together something as venal and gross as these mailers smearing this progressive woman as a supposed Democrat.
Yeah. I mean, it's very strange, right? Like, we have talked on here before about the IBEW, the Union for the DWP Workers, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and their leader, who is extremely pugnacious, Brian Darcy. He has repeatedly fought with city leadership over their attempts to change the way that power is generated by the DWP, the way that, well, I mean, just like the notion of the city's Green New Deal, which we've all criticized as not going far enough. The DWP union has said that it is extreme in the way that they are doing here against Lorraine Lundquist. But that being said, the union, I mean, even though they are attacking what has now been adopted by the city, this Green New Deal plan, they have the support of other council members here. They're making these attacks against Lorraine Lundquist on behalf of John Lee, who is also supported by a raft of sitting city council members.
All Democrats, by all the way, Democrats. Supposedly.
It doesn't make sense. It goes not only contrary to their stated platform, the policies that they're trying to push forward, but they're supporting somebody who is tarring the proposals that they actually say that they want.
New council president Nuri Martinez supporting John Lee in this race. Monica Rodriguez from Council District 7 supporting John Lee. Joe Buscaino, who represents the San Pedro area, former LAPD officer, supporting John Lee. And Mitch O'Farrell, who represents one of the bluest districts in the city, has also jumped into this race in favor of the Republican as of 3 weeks ago. It really just undercuts any desire that they claim to have to implement any progressive agenda whatsoever. John Lee has been outspoken in opposing everything. He didn't support HHH. He doesn't support any like new mobility strategy, any supportive housing in his district. And all of these people claim to want those things and yet are out stumping for this guy. Meanwhile, not a single council member has jumped in to support Lorraine Lundquist. She doesn't have one council member on her endorsement list on her site. The Democrat running against a guy, he is a Republican.
He's a Republican. Has been a Republican his entire adult life until he decided that it was political suicide.
Yes. Oh, and also, by the way, Herb Wesson, outgoing council president, is also supporting John Lee.
Right. I mean, there's no political substance behind it. I mean, to the point about Mitch O'Farrell, like you said, not only is he giving John Lee a name to put on a list of endorsements, he is out there speaking on behalf of John Lee, actively throwing his political weight behind this incumbent who is torching the city's, would be if he had any power, torching the city's progress towards an economically, ecologically resilient future. That is John Lee's platform, basically. Why are our council members doing this? Like, why are they doing this?
I think it would be too generous to even say that it's like policy related at all. I think the only thing that matters is, are you in the club? John Lee was a chief of staff of Mitchell Englander, the previous council member for District 12. They've all known each other for a long time. It is the most like backslappy environment possible. And this is how you get a body that is almost entirely male, has like some of them have literally grown up in this culture. How you get someone like Eric Garcetti, who was born to the former district attorney. like it is so closed off to anyone who hasn't like done their time in it. And once you have, they will protect you at all costs.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we really, as Angelenos, cannot afford to be naive about this. I think that what we're seeing in this election and what we're going to continue to see is that these incumbents, the sitting city council members, are closing ranks because they are fucking scared. Like, I mean, honestly, we've talked a lot about this, the election cycle, where for a long time it was in an off year. The election was in a random month specifically to depress turnout. It was very good at depressing turnout. Now the local elections are aligned with state and federal. It is going to be a different electorate. And the city council members are no doubt seeing that. They're seeing candidates like Lorraine Lundquist, like Nithya Raman, like Aura Vasquez, who also was the recipient of a bizarre Twitter tirade by Mark Ridley Thomas and mailers sent out by a joint PAC in support of Herb Wesson and Mark Ridley Thomas, who, as we've talked about, are trying to swap Mark Ridley Thomas, being the current and outgoing supervisorial District 2 seat holder, Herb Wesson being the current and outgoing City Council District 10 seat holder. They are swapping. They're also sharing a PAC, which is really swell. I'm glad they like each other so much. But candidates like Lorraine and Nithya and Aura are a distinct threat to the rule by this really closed off boys club who have nothing but disdain for the electorate. So it makes sense that Mitch O'Farrell, we've talked about on this show, he's extremely vulnerable. He's lucky he's not running this year. He's running in 2022, and he sees somebody like John Lee as probably a stand-in for himself. Mitch O'Farrell is going to receive a challenge from a candidate who is, I mean, I would say to his left.
A candidate?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, a candidate who is not to his left, because that implies that Mitch O'Farrell has positions on any substantial policy discussion that you might be able to think of, which he does not. He is, you know, kind of like just an empty suit who shows up every so often to celebrate a C-list Hollywood figure getting their name on the Walk of Fame. So yes, these people are very threatened by the current state of politics, and I think that they should be. But that being said, really, no city council member wants to support Lorraine Lundquist. None of them. I just feel like putting your weight behind John Lee should make you a target, politically speaking.
We did have Councilmember Mike Bonin supported her last election.
Yes.
Came out and endorsed her, but only at the last minute.
A bunch of other people, including Wesson, who is now flipped.
Right.
And a few others, only in the final days.
In the final days. Did they weigh in. And then Bonin did tweet the other day, you know, something about the smears, which were also have been targeted Aura Vasquez, but didn't say he endorsed either of them.
He just said,
these smears are happening. But
yeah,
I mean, that it's time. You got a few days, people. Like, maybe you could, you know, say something on Monday. That would be great.
It's a departure from the previous special election. But of course, that was to fill an open seat, but it's also a departure from even a couple of years ago. You had a Mitch O'Farrell supporting the challenger to Gil Cedillo.
That once again had nothing to do with policy whatsoever. Mitch O'Farrell and Gil Cedillo hate each other personally.
Right.
And so Mitch O'Farrell was willing to endorse his opponent, who turned out to be
an absolute
creep.
So yeah, but you do have to wonder what kind of conversations city council members and their staffs are having about this, that nobody, even somebody that you might expect like Mike Bonin, because he hasn't supported John Lee, has he? Not to my knowledge.
No.
But not also not supporting Lorraine Lundquist.
Right.
So
yes, there are a number of candidates who have stayed out of the race entirely, but they have either supported John Lee or nobody at all. And I want to point out all three of the grassroots candidates you mentioned, Lorraine, Nithya, and Aura, are women who are running against men who either have been accused of varying degrees of sexual misconduct or of protecting a son who was accused of that exact thing. A cultural shift that would be great. Oh, let's talk about the smears against Aura specifically. She has been talking about how Mark Ridley Thomas, the current supervisor, has taken a lot of money from fossil fuel interests. And he put up a whole page on his website, say like begins with, I think, like the the Webster's definition of hypocrisy or whatever, saying that like Ara Vasquez has also been taking oil and gas money. She took money from Assembly Member Blanca Rubio, who represents the Eastern San Gabriel Valley,
right,
who in turn has gotten donations from oil and gas interests. So that's how they do it. They launder money through Blanca Rubio. And so see this hypocrisy. Yeah. And then it's like, this is so bad. What about yours? Like, what are, like, what you're like, just taking it directly.
When somebody point blank asks Mark Ridley Thomas, do you support, one of Ara Vasquez's primary points in this election has been that she supports Stand, who we've talked about on this show. Mm-hmm.
100 foot radius.
2,500.
Sorry.
I believe 2,500 foot.
I have on the brain how far you have to set up a table from a polling center. That's 100 feet.
We protect 20, people better from that than we do from active oil wells in this state.
So Stand, which is, for those who don't know, Los Angeles is historically an oil town dating back to like the early 20th century. And currently, even to this day, is the site of the largest urban oil field in the country. There are a ton of active oil drilling sites throughout the county and a ton that are in the city of Los Angeles specifically, particularly in South LA, parts of which are included in this city District 10 where Ara Vasquez is running. So she has made it a point of her campaign that she supports what Stand is after, this 2,500 foot buffer zone, where if you have residential homes, you are not going to have active drilling within that 2,500 foot buffer. Now, Mark Ridley Thomas has been asked about this directly, and his response is not a response at all. He basically just gets this real visible, I'll post it to our podcast Twitter, this visible umbrage.
That
somebody is like asking him or trying to take him to task for decisions that he has made in the name of the public that are not necessarily in the interest of the public. And that is his, that's his approach, is you are challenging me. What is your right to challenge me on decisions that I've made? Mm-hmm. Then he's turning around and he's saying, well, Ara Vasquez is, you know, friends with somebody who's friends with somebody who works for a fossil fuel company. So why would we believe her that she's for this thing that she said she's for? I will tell you outright that I don't support that. I mean, it's really no contest. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's all the election stuff for now. Let's talk about this Larchmont Playground. I am so excited to get into this. This is the purest, uncut, next door shit.
And I don't even know about this. I'm excited,
Alyssa,
to hear about this.
Please, take it away.
Okay, so if you've been to Larchmont, tell me that you go there often, right? A thriving hub in the middle of Los Angeles. Small town charm. There's a parking lot, right? There's a little like shopping strip, and there's a little parking lot where you could park, and then you could go to some stores that are located.
And then we're paying us, so don't say anything.
I honestly don't even know what's there. I mean, I haven't been there in
$600.
The reason I do go there sometimes is because of the farmer's market. They have a really great, very small, well curated farmer's market in this parking lot.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most beloved, and rightfully so, nice farmers market that the community will kill and die for.
As you will see. And this is an...
I can tell this
I think this proposal
already
has been around for a while to take, I believe it is 6 parking spaces and make a playground in the parking lot. One of the reasons being that during the farmers market, there's just not a lot of places for kids to play. Like the Silver Lake Farmers Market has a big bouncy house they've put in there, and you know, just to give, you know, people bring their kids and they can't really do much at a farmers market. So it's a really great idea. So that's part of the impetus of just having, you know, something there. But also there are some parks not super close to the like downtown area of Larchmont. There's a really nice one, I would say like 3 or 4 or 5 blocks away. But you just to have a little bit of green space is nice, or a place for kids to play is nice, especially when you have like an ice cream shop and like, you know, all these other things where, and then just not a very hospitable street. There's not a lot of places to sit. Sure. There's not a lot, you know, there's just not a lot to do. So then I guess there was a story that was saying that it was happening.
But apparently, I heard that neither of those, neither the desire for more green space or for a place to kids to, for kids to play during the farmer's market, was the primary reason
right.
the park was put in there. What was...
Well, nothing's happened yet. It's just a drawing. Yes, yeah.
Was drawn.
Are you going to talk about the rumor?
I want you to talk about it.
Somebody, people are saying that the playground is being proposed to block the proposal of a dispensary on Larchmont, like on the main drag, and that you wouldn't be able to put in a dispensary if there was a playground within, you know, what's the oil radius? 420 feet, I guess. So. But
I find that extremely credible. Much more so than that, like, neighbors have gotten together and said, get rid of this parking lot and turn it into a place where kids can play. That I don't believe for one second.
So there's some, I don't know, whatever the thing that put it over the edge in next door. There was a story in the local paper or something, whatever. But now there's all this conversation about how the farmer's market is actually, you know, at risk and they might be relocating, and that the loss of 6 parking spaces to a playground would be a reason that they would leave, because like 2 vendors would have to move or be somehow reconfigured into this. So, and a friend of mine who lives in the neighborhood sent me, I'm not even kidding, hundreds of pages of Nextdoor screen grabs of this conversation. I mean, literally hundreds. So there is now a meeting set up with, it's Rue's district, but not until after the election. So you can only imagine what is being said now in these weeks, you know, before the election, about how the playground politics are going to play.
Oh my God. I would give my right arm for this to be a lame duck next door meeting.
So the meeting's scheduled to after, you know, I think next week, sometime after the election. But I mean, this is the six, first of all, 6 parking spaces. We can talk about that as like a, you know, the smallest possible piece that you could give to give kids and their parents like a tiniest bit of reprieve as they're like moving around the city. But some of the comments on Nextdoor are like, well, I would never let my kids play that close to a busy street. There's no shade, so there we shouldn't have a playground there. Why would you let your kids go to a place where there are cars? And I just wanted to... these people have yards and they have grass on their own property, and it's their neighborhoods are zoned for single family homes.
Why don't
and
those like, kids get a membership to the country club like the rest of us?
And it was just, I mean, I can't, it's such a, the same thing is probably playing out in so many neighborhoods in LA, but it just to see people arguing about like, And literally people who are parents saying, well, I would never take my children to a place like that. I would never take my kids to a small playground in a parking lot. And I was like, well, I guess you have that option if you can drive to the next one over. But I don't know if Larchmont it can't be doing well, right? The little business district there. I mean, it can't be like...
It's the only commercial strip in Hancock Park. I mean,
it can't be like thrive. I mean, there can't be small businesses doing well. And I mean, it's got to be... I've seen like chains moving in there, right? So like...
But if any neighborhood like that is doing well, I would imagine it is large. Everyone I know who lives there is walking in there.
Yeah, constantly. No, I mean, I think
Go Get 'Em Tiger does very well.
Right,
there.
Right. No, I mean, I don't mean like, I guess the businesses are probably fine, but I can't see it can't be a place that is like a place like Brentwood or all these other places where it needs to have some kind of change come over it, or else it's just going to be a bunch of people who don't have kids living in this neighborhood, right? That are not able to move there or have young families move into there to take advantage of this area. And that's what we're probably seeing happening in a lot of places.
Where did the playground proposal come from? Actually from the neighborhood council? Or?
My understanding was that the Councilmember Rue's office actually did go in and put down some like blue mats kind of for kids to play in during the farmer's market in some way. that would, and this is the rumor, that would satisfy the requirements of a playground that would prevent a dispensary from going in on Larchmont Boulevard,
right,
which some neighborhoods were concerned about. So you have this tactical NIMBYism where you just by like putting down
that
these,
backfired.
Yeah. And now it's like kind of at war with itself. But then I did see in some of the next door comments that people sent me that live in the neighborhood saying, like, if there were a playground here, but then the farmer's market could stay, some people were saying like that would be OK. But then others were saying like, no, you get rid of these parking spaces, like I'm done.
And clearly the only solution here is to close Larchmont Boulevard for the whole business district.
Right.
It would not impact a single person. There are many places to drive around that area. It should not be a place people are cutting through to get to like Wilshire or anything. None of that should be there. They should close the entire street. They should put a playground in the middle of the street. They can have the farmer's market on the closed street. I mean, it's one of the most perfect. It will never happen because these people will never take away parking.
Beverly to Melrose?
Not even. Yeah. I mean, you could close a smaller, it's Beverly and like, you know, to like second or third, like on the middle of the foot. But yes, it's not that far. I mean, this is the kind of thing, but it will never happen because people will look at will count the number of parking spaces and say, I can't get further away from my bagel or whatever.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming through with the cultural Marxism creeping Sharia take.
It has already become a very divisive campaign issue. And I've heard from people that live in the neighborhood that Councilmember Rue has been going to a lot of people's houses personally and saying, like, I treasure the farmer's market. I'll never get rid of it. But Nithya and Sarah Kate, on the other hand, like both of them have said that they will detonate the farmer's market.
This one, a giant playground and a giant dispensary all going together.
I mean, have you seen Sarah Kate and Nithya? They're always walking around with these kids, right?
How dare they?
They want their kids breeders to have somewhere to play.
God.
Larchmont is so fast. They changed the egg product at Sam's Bagels, which I used to really love. Well, it used to be real eggs and now it's egg product. So that would, if any campaign that will change it back to the real eggs. It is so disgusting now. I'm so sorry to Sam's Bagels, which I really do love. But their egg sandwiches, I can't eat anymore. My other Larchmont story. Did you ever go to Larchmont Bungalow when it was there?
It was in Larchmont,
Now it's in Echo Park.
Right.
Oh, I thought they just opened a new
not
one. I didn't know
that.
They had to leave.
Should be not allowed to name your... If you relocate, you cannot keep the same name. I'm sorry. It's too confusing.
I'll tell you, this is my understanding for why they had to relocate. I don't know if you ever went in there and saw that all the furniture had price tags on it, all the chairs and tables that you would like sit in. And it was because they weren't technically licensed as a restaurant. They had a furniture store, like license, and couldn't really serve food.
But
did like IKEA style, like served food, and like technically you could buy any.
You were
of the,
eating in their showroom.
Any of the furniture, but that's how they like got around some.
That's why they had to move to Echo Park.
And then the people are like, "Hey, you can't do this anymore."
I'm gonna go spend some time in Larchmont with my kids and have them, you know, like run around and trouble people. And I think I'll hopefully could be a good advocate for a caged situation in a parking lot where I could store my children instead.
Anything else that we have to get into this week?
I don't think so. Everybody, please vote. Please vote.
Please vote
in your municipal elections. We have tried very hard to make it as easy as possible for you. And the city is doing so as well. So
I love seeing the tweets from Dean Logan, our, you know, voting czar. I don't know what to call him, but they have a mobile voting unit they take around. They took it to the downtown women's center. So they actually have the ability to take the voting ability to people who might not be able to get out. Mm-hmm. And I'm still going to go on election day because I just like the thrill of election day. So I'm going to be putting on my stickers and walking to my polling place per usual. So,
yeah, the LA Times put out a report on how, if you are unhoused, how they've tried to make it as easy as possible for you to vote in this election. You can put down an intersection as your address and they'll walk you through the entire process. And I know that Nithya's campaign and some others are going around to communities of people who are homeless, like getting them to get engaged and vote, and many of them are apparently much more tied into issues related to city government than people who are housed, as you can imagine, because their lives are affected and sometimes threatened every single day by the policies that the city imposes. Thank you so much for listening to LA Podcast. exciting show we'll have next week as we sift through all of the results of this wild election. Looking forward to it. See you then. Bye.
Podcast.